A few introductory comments. At first I thought of apologizing for the content of what I wanted to say tonight, because I haven't looked at the notes for this since I gave it twice last summer. And I was looking them over today and I was very unhappy with them. I kept reading them, trying to figure out why I not disliked, but I was sort of uncomfortable with what I'd written at that time. And one thing I realized tonight was that I had really underestimated, in a lot of senses, the ability of Holden Village to teach in a year in many ways. You know, my writing style that was represented from last summer is now foreign to me. And it's a good feeling in a lot of senses that Holden has changed my opinions on much of this. And so consequently, the notes that I'm using, I'm going to be adding quite a lot to. And so feel free at any time to ask me to stop, to ask me to repeat anything, or to clarify whatever is unclear for you. I think if you pick up any anthology of modern short stories, and just take a look through the index, you'll find that the majority of them will be Russian. Take a look at the great books in the library, and you'll find a great many pages devoted to Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. I think for all of us, Russia has sort of a special kind of fascination. When you think of Russia, various images come to mind, and I've brought a book that Time Life Library puts out on Russia that's very easy to read, has good maps, good history, and lets you in on some of this, gives you some really excellent color pictures along with their own writing here. That gives you a sense for the people, a sense for their history, so that they're not so totally foreign. It's a good way to become accustomed, I think, in the beginning to this literature. And I know many have not been reading this month the Brothers Karamazov. People in the Lifestyle Program and a few others have. It's sort of a big one to start with. I don't think anyone should be frightened off from reading this literature by its immenseness. Many of these novels, War and Peace, of course, is 1,500 pages. This is 800 in small print. There are very many excellent short stories by Dostoevsky, and I'm going to read a portion from one tonight, The Notes from Underground, so you get a sense for the style and the real enjoyment that this particular literature contains. So I think I'll just pass this around. You can just take a look at it during the talk. But Russia always has this kind of special fascination. I think you find that out. Just think of the countries in Europe. Think of Spain, for instance. That always has somewhat of a different kind of connotation, I think, for all of us. Think of France and Norway and Sweden and Denmark and Germany and England. Spain's a little different. The culture's not the same. You think of Russia, and it's in the East and it's in the West. They're shaped by a different tradition than we are. And these traditions include things like the Orthodox Church, the imperial and the communist state, the unique history of the Russian language, which is not simply not our alphabet. I took Russian for 2 years at the University of Minnesota, and it's a really exciting language to get into if you ever get that opportunity at a college or a school somewhere. And I'd like to just talk about some of these influences that have created one of the most spectacular literatures in the history of man. And a knowledge of Marxism will not help here. Where I want to begin is with the spiritual nature of the Russian people, the idea of Russia as the Christian East. And so I'm going to be going through a lot of history, a lot of religious history, and taking sort of a wide view over all of these areas. And then in the coming weeks, I hope to give separate talks on specific Russian authors like Gogol, Lermontov, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, names and books I think that many of you will have heard about. The Russian people, one of the most important things to remember to begin with, is that they have been molded by the Orthodox Church. Christianity first came to Russia in the year 860, and the situation of Russia was something like this. If you look at that map in that book now, you'll notice it's one of the largest nations in the world, if not the largest. And the Duchy of Muscovy was the only place that we could call specifically Russian, about 100-mile radius all around the present city of Moscow. This was ruled by about five princes, and the rest of Russia in this time was ruled by several hundred princes, none of which were allied specifically with each other. Well, several of them got together in 860 and decided that they were going down to Constantinople, which is on the Black Sea, which was then the center of the civilized world, the center of Byzantium. And as often happened with countries or peoples that tried to conquer another, they failed. And as they were blockading the harbor of Constantinople with their vessels, they ran out of food. And Constantinople was doing very well putting up with their siege. And so they sent a little message out to them and said, how would you like to become Christians and go back to Russia? Or how would you like us to come out and sink you? And they decided that they would like to become Christian. So they went back to Russia with the Christianity from this Greek culture in Constantinople. And the quickness with which this took root in Russia has remained just a remarkable thing since. In a period of 40 years, the country was covered with monasteries. It took root there in a way that it took root nowhere else in history. It was the complete unifying element of all these small princes. It was now the one common unifying element among all these governments. And so by the dawn of the year of the first millennium, 1000 AD, we have a terrific amount of Russian religious art, cathedrals, monasteries dedicated to Santa Sophia, the Holy Wisdom, written records come in, a written language common to all these specific princes is developed. You have a brilliant Middle Ages. The church rules over the areas of law, government, and slowly there's a unified nation growing. And if you can get a hold of a map, which I think there's one in there that shows the growth of this state of Russia, you'll see this little tiny dot where Moscow is. And then slowly, over a period of about 200 years, it expands to cover what now we would call the western section of Russia. Well, things went along very well until about the year 1300, when the Mongol hordes invaded from the east. And the Mongol hordes behaved towards religious groups in existence in the same way that Arabs often did. They did not touch religious shrines, religious people, those, for instance, the priests, the metropolitan, which is the name of the Russian, head of the Russian church, somewhat a figure like the Pope, but not claiming to infallibility, an elected post. And so the church, when the hordes came and destroyed the entire social framework of Russia, deposed the king, slaughtered the king's family, destroyed the government, destroyed the army, destroyed the navy, destroyed everything of political power in the state, the only remaining power was the church. And so the church then became that which took over the role of police, arbiter in disputes. If you were married, of course, this would be taken care of the church. Funerals, the courts were run by church officials. Everything is connected with the church. Finally, in about the 15th century, about 1400, these hordes diminish and their influence and are assimilated either into the culture or the larger forces left. And a very important moment came for the Russian people that would have one of the greatest political, religious, and spiritual consequences for their future. In 1439, the Patriarch and Emperor of Constantinople, the center of the Christian world, and all the members of the Orthodox hierarchy went to Italy, to the city of Florence, and signed an act of alliance with Rome. And this was an attempt to join the Orthodox and the Catholic Church, so there would be one Christian church. So even early as this time, there was a rift between these two. The Orthodox churches in the East did not regard themselves as part of the Roman Christianity. And the reason that they wished to join at this time was because the Ottomans, who eventually established the Ottoman Empire, were moving in. See? And they did not have any longer the internal unity or the forces to keep these people at bay. And this was greeted with just a tremendous outcry in Russia. This act of union was looked upon by the Orthodox peoples with a great deal of hostility. And this was particularly strong in Russia, where the Metropolitan of Kiev, a city in the southern part of Russia, was then the spiritual leader of the nation. A Greek named Isidore, one of those who had signed this, was driven from the country. The Russians decided on their own to enthrone a new metropolitan, an independent. And then in 1448, this isn't 1449, then 9 years later, something happened which really impressed one of the greatest impressions made on the Russians. Byzantium, the center of the Christian world, the center of civilization, the center of learning, knowledge, the arts, fell. And this was looked upon as a sign from heaven, that these unjust people had paid for what they'd done. What was the one true center left in the whole world of the real Christian faith? Russia. What was the only refuge of this unaltered faith? The one independent Orthodox country, Russia. And so they take up this feeling of being what, I think it was Tim who was talking about it in the session earlier in the winter, the idea of the Third Rome. Two Romes have fallen, the Rome in Italy and the Rome of Constantinople, both centers of the Christian world. There's one more, Moscow, that which contains the true religion. And so this is the beginning of that doctrine. The intense feeling was added to this, that the end of the world was soon at hand and there would not be a fourth Rome. And then this was all finally sealed legitimately by the marriage of Grand Duke Ivan to the Byzantine Empress Zoya, who escaped this invading force, and Moscow was looked on as the direct and legitimate heir of the Byzantine Empire, the seat of the only true religion. See? And this is carried all the way down to Dostoevsky. You'll notice in the Karamazov that there's a great deal of hatred for the Catholic Church. Not simply, it's more than just a feeling of anger with the establishment of the Catholic Church, popes, bishops, etc. But the real feeling of anti-Westernism. In 1871, when Dostoevsky took a trip to Europe with his wife, his second wife, he came back very much convinced that the only hope of the world was in Russia and in the Russian religion, and that the West was completely in decline. So we have Moscow as a direct heir of the Byzantine Empire. And then the new Tsar, the son of this marriage, Ivan IV, drew all the conclusions correctly and assumed the title of Tsar. And Holy Russia, the country, was given this adjective. It's very important to remember in any discussion of Russia, it's Holy Russia. Every country has some kind of title for itself. Mary England, what's La Belle France, I don't know. In Russia, it's Holy Mother Russia. This wasn't just another empire, as far as the Russians were concerned, but a sacred and holy empire. And the idea of the Third Rome was the basic idea on which the state was formed. The kingdom was consolidated and shaped under the messianic idea. The search for true and ideal kingship was characteristic of the Russian people through its history, just as profession of the true Orthodox faith, this faith of Russia, was what identified you as a Russian, just as the profession of the true Orthodox socialism today is what identifies you as a true Russian in contemporary Russia. In exactly the same way, profession of the true communist faith was to be the test of belonging to Soviet Russia. Religion and the state grew up together. This is a very unusual thing, which we did not experience in this country, and no other European country has. The only parallel to it is the Hebrew people, who feel their nation to have been formed from its beginning by the will of God. And this is exactly how the Russians look at theirs, as that which is the legitimate heir of Christianity. And as the same way as messianic consciousness was an attribute of Judaism, it was also an attribute of Russian Orthodoxy. The role of the Tsar was to govern the state, but there was a much more important role, and that was to win souls to the Orthodox faith. And so from its very beginning at this point, you have Russia spreading as a result of this. The Tsars looked upon it as their first and primary duty to win the East, to win the southern areas, to take over Poland. This wasn't a political act. This was a religious duty. And you can draw what connections you wish to present Russian policy. The Orthodox faith was the Russian faith. What was not Russian was not Orthodox faith. In the 1600s, the patriarch, which is the title given to the head of the Russian church, a man named Nikon, tried to make a few changes in the ceremonial practice of the church. And this led to violent protests in popular religions and led to a group of people being formed by the schism from which Dostoevsky and all of these writers and artists come out of. And before I go on with this idea, I want to go back to the year 1860. Now, when the Russian people were converted, they received their Christianity from Byzantium, which is an offspring of Greek culture. But they didn't inherit any of the ancient world. Now, when we look at our own society and our own culture, take a look, for instance, at the set of great books in the library. What's the first volume? Plato. Right? Greek culture. Find a modern history book and see where it starts. It'll start with Greek culture. We look at the Greeks as sort of the home of democracy and the home of civilization. The Russians didn't inherit any of this. They don't have this common ground with us of looking back to the ancient world as the source of our learning. Plato wasn't even translated into Russian till 1812. And the liturgy of the Russian church was in Russian, where ours didn't become English or German or whatever until the Reformation in the 1500s. And we reflect on how much our thinking is affected by Greek thought. We can begin to perceive what I believe an important difference between Russia and the West. Okay? How we view things. College philosophy courses begin in Greece. Russians do not. We call it the birthplace of civilization. These concepts are foreign to Russia. The whole idea of civilization is foreign to Russia, as we'll see in a minute. But to get back to this schism, the schism between those who held the old faith and this new faith. And it wasn't a matter of whether you crossed yourself with two or three fingers. The question was this: was the Russian kingdom a true Orthodox kingdom? Was it fulfilling its messianic vocation? And a popular suspicion arose that the Third Rome had been corrupted and a betrayal of the true faith was taking place. The mighty state was not just and was intertwined with the church, which represented the just role of Christ. And the mingling of the two caused a schism. See? The church was that which they felt had kept this true faith, but the state had corrupted it. And there arose, just as a side comment, this legend of the city of Kitez, which was hidden beneath the lake. The people were said to be seeking the city of Kitez, became a common saying in those days. And a keen apocalyptic consciousness came into being, and with those belonging to the schism, the section known as the priestless. And schism, if you've read any Dostoevsky, is the basis on which every theme has its ground. The double is the name of one of his stories. The man from underground, the man divorced, the man separated from something. The dual nature in the Karamazovs, the sensual part, the religious part. All of these elements fighting together. So division becomes a major literary theme, and we turn to the question, is civilization worth it? We don't ever think about that. We generally think of civilization as slowly moving forward. We are progressing. We have a notion of progress. Injustices are slowly being removed. We're advancing somewhere. This is totally foreign to the Russians. They don't look at society in the same kind of way. And this isn't a doubt that you find among the uneducated, but those at the highest levels of Russian society. Russian writers, especially the most notable, do not believe in the stability of civilization, in the stability upon those principles that we say the world rests. They're full of terrible forebodings, and Russian literature is the most prophetic in the world. It's full of predictions. Take a red pen, underline in the Grand Inquisitor scene those parts that deal with the future that have not yet come to pass, and you will have a book covered with red. European literature doesn't know this sort of religious and social unrest. It belongs to a civilization more fixed and crystallized, more self-contained and calm. Russian thinkers, when they are of note, spiritually always sought not so much to make the beautiful novel, not to paint the beautiful picture, not to produce the beautiful music, but to bring about a perfect expression of some kind of truth in life. And Russian literature reached a stage beyond classicism in Europe. It was realistic, but not in a scholastic sense, but rather realistic in a religious sense. You notice this right away in Dostoevsky. This is a religious novel. Now, who are the Russian people who I've been talking about? I'll give you some breakdown of how their society was organized. The bulk of the people were peasants and would remain so until they were emancipated in 1831. This caused a lot of anger from the nobles. It also caused a lot of anger among the peasants because they didn't get anything except really a paper claiming that they were free. They lived in this grip of serfdom. Inwardly, they lived by the Orthodox faith, and that gave them the power to bear the sufferings of this life. The people regarded serfdom as wrong and an injustice, but they assigned the blame not to the Tsar, but to the ruling class. The Russians, right up to the point of the revolution, always felt that the Tsar was being tricked, that he didn't know, and that they awaited the time during which the Tsar would correct this. The Tsar was innocent of these things, but the nobles and the bureaucracy were the ones who were at fault. To the cultured classes, the mass of people remained a sort of mystery, of which the secret was not yet discovered. They felt in the still, inarticulate people, they concealed a great truth about life, and the day would come when the people would have their say. And this brought about an idea that was quite common in the last century. It's very often spoken of in novels, a theme called the authority of the soil, that the peasant speaks with some kind of authority because he works the ground, and the ground has a very sacred kind of imagery associated with it always in Russia. You notice in the opening of Shivago, they're singing, "Rest eternal, the fullness of the earth belongs to the Lord," as they bury Shivago's mother in the ground. By the 19th century, Russia had assumed the form of an immense, unbounded peasant country, enslaved, illiterate, but with its own popular culture based on a faith with a ruling noble class, idle, and with little culture, which had lost its sense of nationality. Read War and Peace. You almost have to know French. There are pages and pages in French. The nobility spoke French. Several of the czars didn't even know Russian. And you have this kind of divorce then that is really going to explode in the revolution. When Nicholas II was home, he and Alexandra spoke French. She was German and knew very little Russian in any event and never really attempted to learn it. So you have the czar at the top, who is regarded as a very strong religious figure by the people. Okay, now I want to turn to the class called the intelligentsia in the 19th century, the group who were writers of the period, the group to who Dostoevsky belonged, Tolstoy, these people who are a result of that schism, who felt that there was something rotten going on in Russia, something rotten in the state. Because the state had given up its religious connotations. Solzhenitsyn's always also a product of this. Now, when we say in our own society, a word like intelligentsia, we have various meanings we immediately associate with it. Brains, read a lot, quotable quotes, gone to Harvard, and whatever other adjectives come to mind. To the Russians, it's very different. A peasant could have been a member of the intelligentsia. It has nothing to do with being an intellectual or having brains. It's a group of people in Russia at this time held together by ideas, and ideas of a specific kind. To be a member of the intelligentsia was to have specific feelings about sociology. But owing to the Russian political conditions, which were, of course, extremely harsh, the press was censored. Dostoevsky has long letters to his censor, trying to get him to include various parts of his book, you know, where they would knock this out. Any bad mention of the Orthodox faith would be knocked out. The intelligentsia found itself then in a position divorced from practical social work. When you get an idea, for instance, now let's see, society can be better in this way if we adopt this policy, and you have absolutely no means to put that policy into use, it leads to a type of social daydream. And in the Russia of autocracy and serfdom, the most radical ideas of socialism and anarchism were developed, and they were developed by the literary critics and by the authors. The impossibility of political action led to this. Politics were transferred to thought and literature. In the 19th century, the literary critics are some of the greatest leaders of political upheavals. The intelligentsia reminds one more of a monastic order or sect with its own intolerant ethics, its own obligatory outlook on life, its own manners and customs by which its members could be identified. The intelligentsia lived in schism from its actual environment, which it considered evil. Now, to understand this, I want to just go over a story that I think may clarify what my point is. When Khrushchev went to Russia, when Khrushchev came to the United States and Nixon was showing him over various farming methods in this country, he went to a chicken hatchery. He was very interested because they didn't have any of these in Russia. So he was looking around, noticing everything, taking notes and nodding. And they came to egg incubators. And he's looking at these incubators and he thought this was just great. They looked really effective. And he said, tell me, Mr. Nixon, what temperature do you keep these eggs at? He said, oh, about 120. And I said, okay. Well, he had to explain how this would increase production and everything. So he went back to Russia and said, well, gave out this big order to make a new hatchery, which they did. And he said, we'll show the Americans, we will heat them to 240 degrees, and we will hatch the eggs twice as fast. Okay? Now this shows something I want to get to now on the way that the Russians adopt and have adopted various Western ideas. Russians possess a particular faculty for absorbing Western ideas and giving them completely new form. But the assimilation of Western ideas and doctrines by the Russian intelligentsia was for the most part a matter of dogma. What was scientific theory in the West became among the Russian intelligentsia a matter of dogma. What was scientific theory in the West, a matter of dispute, became a religious revelation among the intelligentsia. To take an example like Darwinism, suppose you're living in, 1870 in England, and you are trying to decide whether or not you believe that man descended from the apes. You would go, perhaps if you're a scientist, to some club, and this would be a real hotly disputed matter. And people would bring various philosophies and arguments for and against it to the front, and you'd argue about it. But in Russia, which had an almost religious reverence for science, and particularly among the intelligentsia, if you became a Darwinist, it was then a matter of dogma. Anyone who didn't believe in Darwin was like an atheist. He didn't accept the right religion. When a member of the intelligentsia became a Darwinist, Darwinism was not a biological theory that you disputed. It was a dogma. And those who didn't accept the dogma awoke an attitude of moral suspicion. See? You're not a good person because you don't believe in Darwin. And this is carried right across. A lot of seeds, you see, were already present for the present communist system.
My God, if one could tell categorically all that we Russians have gone through during the last 10 years
in the way of spiritual development, all of the realists would shriek that it was pure fantasy. And yet it would be realism. It is the one true deep realism, God save us. And the realities that offered themselves to these writers, that which shaped their backgrounds, that what they drew on in the last century, was truly fantastic. You have 1% of the population literate. Deal with that first. The rest cannot read or write. You have a terrified despotism, a church preyed upon by apocalyptical expectations, an immensely gifted intelligentsia uprooted, unable to perform any of its ideas because of government censorship. Many of them went abroad, many of them went back to the soil to work with the peasants. Legions of exiles, raging debates between atheists and believers, reactionaries and nihilists, and weighing on all spirits like one of the summer storms that Turgenev described so beautifully, the premonition of disaster. Now, we don't know this. The last century in Europe, although certainly there was a great deal of anarchism had some popular moments, as nihilism did, they didn't believe that the end of the world was coming, which the Russians did. The end of the world was right close. Yeah.
You said that only 1% population is literate. Then who are they writing for? How is their work broadcast then?
The 1% of the population would be that part of the including the intelligentsia who could read and the nobility. Okay. That was it.
Russia would have had a lot of people.
Yeah.
But what if the Soviet Union was quite expensive?
Mm-hmm.
About what time was that?
That'd be about 1870. It's about the situation at that time. Okay. So you have masses of uneducated people, yeah, as you still do today. You know, I think the literacy rate, I think last year was about 42, which is an amazing feat in 50 years. Yeah. So, the premonitions assumed religious aspects. Belinsky, one of the greatest Russian critics, states, "The quest for the existence of God is the final and all-determining focus of Russian thought. In Russian political thinking, the shadow of the kingdom of God had moved terribly close to the declining kingdom of man. The Russian mind was literally God-haunted, waiting for this moment to come." Now, in the middle of all this turmoil, we have the author Dostoevsky, who lived from 1881 to 1881. And his works very well describe the kind of inner turmoil the country was going through at this time. And just to give you a little idea of the flavor of it, I want to read you from one of his, probably the most famous of his short stories, The Notes from Underground, so you get an idea of what this is like. So you know who this is. It's a man totally divorced from society, living totally by himself, who is going to be telling you this story. Dostoevsky has this little note at the beginning. "Both the author of the notes and the notes themselves are, of course, fictitious. Nevertheless, such persons as the author of such memoirs not only may, but must exist in our society if we take into consideration the circumstances which led to the formation of our society. It's my intention to bring before our reading public, more conspicuously than is usually done, one of the characters of our recent past. He is one of the representatives of a generation that is still with us. I'm a sick man. I'm a spiteful man. No, I'm not a pleasant man at all. I believe there's something wrong with my liver. However, I don't know a damn thing about my liver. Neither do I know whether there is anything really wrong with me. I'm not under medical treatment, never have been, though I do respect medicine and doctors. In addition, I am extremely superstitious, at least sufficiently so to respect medicine. I am well educated enough not to be superstitious, but I am superstitious anyway. The truth is, I refuse medical treatment out of spite. I don't suppose you'll understand that. Well, I do. I don't expect I shall be able to explain to you who it is I am actually trying to annoy in this case of my spite. I realize full well that I can't hurt the doctors by refusing to be treated by them. I realize better than anyone that by all this I am only hurting myself and no one else. Still, the fact remains that if I refuse to be medically treated, it is only out of spite. My liver hurts, damn it. Well, damn it, let it hurt. The more it hurts, the better. I've been living like this a long time, about 20 years, I should think. I'm 40 now. I used to be in the civil service, but I'm no longer there now. I was a spiteful civil servant. I was rude and took pleasure in being rude. Mind you, I never accepted any bribes, so that I had to at least to find something to compensate myself for that. A silly joke, but I shan't cross it out. I wrote it thinking it would sound very witty, but now that I've seen myself that I merely wanted to indulge in a bit of contemptible bragging, I shall let it stand on purpose. Ha! Whenever people used to come to my office on some business, I snarled at them and felt as pleased as punch when I succeeded in making one of them really unhappy. I nearly always did succeed. They were mostly a timid lot. What else can you expect people to be who come to government office? And further, ha ha, after this you'll no doubt be finding some pleasure in toothaches too, you cry with a laugh. Well, why not? There's pleasure even in a toothache, I reply. I had toothache for a whole month, and I know there's pleasure in it. For you see, if you have toothache, you don't lose your temper in silence. You groan, but these groans of yours are not sincere groans. You are groans mixed with malice. And it is the malice here that matters. By these groans the sufferer expresses his pleasure. If he did not feel any pleasure, he wouldn't groan. That is an excellent example, gentlemen, and I'm going to develop it. He's totally just off balance, you know? But he gains his sanity a little later. He has insights into the human condition that come from a madman. That, you know, this is an example of that kind of just split in a personality. A man not only divorced from society, but divorced from himself. where various parts of him will at one point in this story take command. See? Another time he'll be real nice. You know? Another time he'll stab a cat to death. You know? You'll see what happens. In these groans there is expressed, in the first place, the whole purposelessness of your pain, which is so humiliating to your consciousness. The crowning stroke of nature, for which you, of course, don't care, but from which you suffer all the same while she goes scot-free. They express the consciousness of the fact that even though you had no enemies, you do have pain. The consciousness that for all the dentists in the world, you are entirely at the mercy of your teeth. That is someone that if someone should desire it, your teeth would stop aching. And if he does not, they will go on aching another 3 months. And that, finally, if you are still unconvinced and still keep on protesting, all that is left for your gratification is to give yourself a thrashing or hit the wall with your fist as hard as you can, and absolutely nothing more. You are laughing? I'm very glad, I'm sure. I'm afraid, gentlemen, my jokes are in very bad taste. They are lame and a bit confused and show a lack of self-confidence, I suppose. That is because I have no self-respect. But can a man of acute sensibility respect himself at all? And then finally, a little further, he's going to talk about human history. In short, you can say anything you like about world history, anything that might enter the head of a man with the most disordered imagination. One thing, though, you cannot possibly say about it. You cannot say that it's sensible. History isn't sensible. If you did, you would choke at the first word. And moreover, this is the sort of curious thing you come across almost every minute. Continually there crop up in life such sensible and moral people, such sages and lovers of humanity, whose only object seems to be to live all their lives as sensible and moral as possible, to be, as it were, a shining light to their neighbors for the sole purpose of proving to them that it is really possible to live morally and sensibly in the world. And what happens? We know that many of these altruists, sooner or later, toward the end of their lives, were untrue to themselves, committing some folly, sometimes, indeed, of a most indecent nature. So let me ask you this question. What can you expect of man, seeing that he is a being endowed with such strange quality? Why, shower all the earthly blessings upon him, drown him in happiness, head over ears, so that only bubbles should be visible on the surface, as on the surface of water. Bestow such economic prosperity upon him as would leave him with nothing else to do but sleep, eat cakes, and only worry about keeping world history going, and even then he will, man will, out of sheer ingratitude, out of sheer desire to injure you personally, play a dirty trick on you. He would even risk his cakes and ale and deliberately set his heart on the most deadly trash, the most uneconomic absurdity, and do it, if you please, for the sole purpose of infusing into this positive good sense his deadly, fantastic element. It is just his fantastic dreams, his most patent absurdities, that he will desire above all else for the sole purpose of proving to himself, as though that were so necessary, that men are still men and not keys on a piano on which the laws of nature are indeed playing any tune they like, but are in danger of going on playing until no one is able to desire anything except a mathematical table. And that is not all. Even if he really were nothing but a piano key, even if this were proved to him by natural science and mathematically, even then he would refuse to come to his senses, but would, on purpose, just in spite of everything, do something out of sheer ingratitude. The one thing he's getting at here is the total absurdity is one thing that I think it is so fascinating about Dostoevsky. He doesn't back away from any paradoxes, and he doesn't back away from the fact that life does not make sense. Actually, I carry his point. But if he has no other remedy, he will plan destruction and chaos, and he will devise all sorts of sufferings, and in the end, he will carry his point. He will send a curse over the world, and as only man can curse, this in his privilege, which distinguishes him from other animals, he may by his curse alone attain his object, that is, really convince himself that he is a man and not a piano key. If you say that this, too, can be calculated by the mathematical table, chaos and darkness and curses, so that the mere possibility of calculating it all beforehand would stop it all and reason would triumph in the end. Well, if that were to happen, man would go purposely mad in order to rid himself of reason and carry his point. Okay? He's also arguing here against the kind of philosophy that was very prevalent at this point of Marxism, that, you know, it's possible to work these good things out through good education in man, that, you know, it's all very possible to heal society in this way. Saying, no, whatever you do, man will put a bad mark on it. I believe this is so. I give you my word for it. For it seems to me that the whole meaning of human life can be summed up in the one statement that man only exists for the purpose of proving to himself every minute that he is a man and not an organ stop. In Dostoevsky, everything is steeped in this kind of molten, fiery atmosphere. Everything's in violent movement. Nothing is fixed or finely shaped. The prophetic element is very strong in him. He faced the future, foresaw much of it, predicted the revolution, which he gave a date of 1920. He was also a revolutionary in spite of conservative appearances of many of his views. He disliked and chided the revolutionary intelligentsia because he saw the denial of the freedom of spirit as the final result of the ideas of a revolution based on godlessness. I want to read now a portion from just before the Grand Inquisitor scene between two of the Karamazov brothers, Ivan and Alyosha. Listen, I spoke of children only to make my case clearer. Of the other tears of humanity with which the earth is soaked from its crust to its center, I will say nothing. I have narrowed my subject on purpose, and I recognize in all humility that I cannot understand why the world is arranged as it is. Men are themselves to blame, I suppose. They were given paradise, they wanted freedom, and stole fire from heaven, though they knew they would become unhappy. So there's no need to pity them. With my earthly Euclidean understanding, all I know is that there is suffering, and that there are none guilty. That cause follows effect, simply and directly, that everything flows and finds its level, but that's only Euclidean nonsense. I know that, and I can't consent to live by it. What comfort is it to me that there are none guilty, and that cause follows effect simply and directly, and that I know it? I must have justice, or I will destroy myself. And not justice in some remote, infinite time and space, but here on earth. Justice that I can see myself. I have believed in it. I want to see it. And if I am dead by then, let me rise again. For if it all happens without me, it will be too unfair. Surely I haven't suffered simply that I, my crimes and my sufferings, may manure the soil of future harmony for somebody else. I want to see with mine own eyes the lamb lie down with the lion and the victim rise up and embraces murder. I want to be there when everyone suddenly understands what it has all been about. All the religions of the world are built on this longing, and I'm a believer. Okay? This is the kind of anger that comes out of him over the suffering of the world. Why is the world such a rotten place?
He was the
founder of geometry, the science of geometry. And in light of that, that longing in that character to come to some kind of sense in the world, to attain the aspect of hope, I want to read from the introduction of Jürgen Moltmann, who wrote The Crucified God, a little bit from the theology of hope, what it means to hope in Christ. Joseph Pieper has very neatly shown how hopelessness can assume two forms. It can be presumption, and it can be despair. Both are forms of the sin against hope. Presumption is a premature, self-willed anticipation of the fulfillment of what we hope for from God. See, Ivan wants to snatch the future out of God's hands and establish justice on earth. And he says, if I'm not there, I want to be woken up. Raise me up from the dead so that I can see this take place. Despair is the premature, arbitrary anticipation of non-fulfillment of what we hope for from God. Both forms of hopelessness, by anticipating the fulfillment or by giving up hope, cancel the wayfaring nature of hope. Thus the kindled hope turns against the one who hopes and consumes it. This is Ivan's trouble. His very hopes for justice are eating him alive. Hopelessness can assume two forms. It can be presumption, and it can be despair. Both are forms of the sin against hope.
Presumption is a premature, self-willed anticipation of the fulfillment of what we hope for from God. Despair is the premature, arbitrary anticipation of the non-fulfillment of what we hope for from God. One is God will never do it, and the other one is, why aren't you doing it now? See? Both forms of hopelessness, by anticipating the fulfillment or by giving up hope, cancel the wayfaring character of hope. Then he goes on, they rebel against the patience in which hope trusts in the God of the promise. They demand impatiently either fulfillment now already or absolutely no hope. That says, thus despair too presupposes hope. The pain of despair surely lies in the fact that a hope is there, but no way opens up towards its fulfillment. See? This is it. Ivan is full of hope, but he's frustrated in it. He has no visible sign of things improving. It's the same with the critics and with the literary authors themselves. They want Russia to be a better place. They have no way to make it a better place in the last century. Thus the kindled hope turns against the one who hopes and consumes him. A little before that, hope finds in Christ not only a consolation in suffering, but also the protest of the divine promise against suffering. If Paul calls death the last enemy in 1 Corinthians, then the opposite is also true, that the risen Christ, and with him the resurrection hope, must be declared to be the enemy of death and of a world that puts up with death. Faith takes up this contradiction, and thus becomes itself a contradiction to the world of death. That is why faith, wherever it develops into hope, causes not rest but unrest, not patience but impatience. It does not calm the unquiet heart, but it is itself this unquiet heart in man. Those who hope in Christ can no longer put up with reality as it is, but begin to suffer under it, to contradict it. Peace with God means conflict with the world. It's really good. For the goad of the promised future stabs inexorably into the flesh of every unfulfilled present. And then just one other. Thus faith believes God to be true. Hope awaits the time when this truth shall be manifested. Faith believes that he is our Father. Hope anticipates that he will ever show himself to be a father toward us. Faith believes that eternal life has been given to us. Faith believes that eternal life has been given to us. Hope anticipates that it will sometime be revealed. Faith is the foundation upon which hope rests, hope nourishes, and sustains faith. See? Faith believes in the given promise. Hope awaits its actual appearance. See? This is the point here. And the thing that is so prevalent in all of these works in the last century is this feeling of hopelessness, of being consumed, in a sense, by your own desire to have your hope expressed in some way. Dostoevsky was himself a sort of spiritual communist. He preached the responsibility of all for each. And this comes out in one of the scenes with Father Zossima, a religious figure in the book, who says the following. When a man realizes that he is not only worse than others, but that he is responsible to all men for all and everything, for all human sins, national and individual, only then can the aim of our seclusion be attained. For know, dear ones, that every one of us is undoubtedly responsible for all men and everything on earth, not merely through the general sinfulness of creation, but each one personally for all mankind and every individual man. This knowledge is the crown of life for the monk and for every man and woman. This is what, it reminds me of what Carol said the other night, that you get this sense in Dostoevsky of it's not what you give up, it's what you take on when you become a Christian that counts. See? And what you take on, as Zosima says, is the entire world. You take on your brother, you take on your sister, and you have this battle to win them also. I want to read you a quote by Dostoevsky himself in a letter to his sister that tells something about his own conversion. He was imprisoned at one point in his life for political views, and the government, in order to shake him up after a long imprisonment, took him out to a ditch along with several others, lined him up to be shot, loaded the guns with blanks, and then fired them. You know, it totally terrified him and brought on an increased reaction that he'd always had mildly to epilepsy. This is from Russian Realism, an introduction by Ernest Simmons. Dostoevsky spent nearly 10 years as a convict at Omsk and in compulsory service as a soldier in Siberia before he was permitted to return to St. Petersburg and once again to resume his literary career. There was no essential change in his creative methods, as is commonly maintained, only a steady development of established techniques. If anything, prison defined and deepened his creative urges. But his harsh experiences in Siberia did markedly alter his outlook on life and profoundly influenced the content and spiritual quality of his fiction. His youthful, radical yearning for social reform had been sublimated in a renewed faith in the teachings of Christ and in the power of the Orthodox Church to bring surcease to the troubled existence of Russia. In prison, he had constantly read the New Testament, the only book allowed, and it had taught him, along with his own unhappy experiences, the doctrine of salvation by suffering. Remember in the book where, isn't it Dmitri, who, when he comes to meet Father Zosima, he's bowed to. The reason for this is that they realized in his character the possibility of great evil. And as Lewis says, saints and great sinners are both made of the same stuff. And they realized at that point, almost by revelation, that within Dmitri was the possibility of a great saint as well as a great devil. Shortly after his release, he wrote a woman who had befriended him as a convict and told her of his new faith, a statement that illuminates the spiritual change he'd undergone. Quote, "Here it is. I believe that there is nothing more beautiful, more profound, more sympathetic, more reasonable, more manly, and more perfect than Christ. And not only is there nothing, but I tell myself with jealous love there can be nothing. Besides, if anyone proved to me that Christ was outside the truth, and it really was so that truth was outside Christ, then I should prefer to remain with Christ than with the truth." That's really a great quote. They go on, "The importance of this credo in the development of Dostoevsky's future thought and for the spiritual content of the great novels to come is self-evident. Finally, in prison, he had got to know the common people of Russia as never before, and in their natural gifts and their infinite capacity for patient suffering, he saw more hope for the future of Russia than in all the efforts of the intellectuals." Dostoevsky left Siberia with a mind crammed with rich material for further study and future writing. So, you have this great distinction between the kind of fiction that the Russians produced in the last century and what the rest of the West produced. The tradition of Balzac and Dickens and Flaubert, some of the greatest of the Western authors in the last century, was secular, where the art of Dostoevsky is religious. We're dealing with different techniques and different metaphysics, and central to their purpose is what Berdyaev, a Russian philosopher, has called the quest for the salvation of mankind.